The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is The Urologist Speaks. This is another part two show with vascular surgeon and general surgeon, Dr. Charles Lucas. And again, my co-host joining us is Bahamian general surgeon and surgical oncologist. First fellowship-trained surgical oncologist in Bahamian history, Dr. Wesley Francis. Good evening, Dr. Francis.
Good evening, Bahamas. Always good to be here. And we're here again with Dr. Charlie Lucas, I like to call him, and one of our modern trained vascular surgeons who's here with all of his new techniques, innovations, and bringing advanced technology and vascular surgery to the Bahamas.
So, good evening, Dr. Lucas. We're going to always start with a little policy we have here. We want to create some positivity in our nation, so we want to start with some inspiring quotes for life and living. Number one, let's start with, never be embarrassed to struggle. There is absolutely no shame in working hard to get where you want to be. Don't ruin a good day by thinking about a bad yesterday. Let it go. If someone tells you you can't, they are showing you their limits, not yours. If you live for people's acceptance, you will die from their rejection. Excuses make today easier, but tomorrow harder. Discipline makes today hard, but tomorrow easier. So we all know life is full of struggles. Life is full of ups and downs. It's not how many times you fall down, it's how many times you get up. And a lot of times when you go through many years of struggle, it's even sweeter at the end of the road. So as surgeons, we all know what life is in terms of sacrifice, in terms of doing without, in terms of being perpetually poor, perpetually tired. As they say, you can only make diamonds with the greatest of forces. So I had my admiration to you, Dr. Lucas. I did, when I had to do my 2 years of general surgery before I even started urology, I had to do 6 months of vascular surgery, and they were the toughest 6 months in every respect of my entire life. It was normal to do 13, 14-hour surgeries, and the next day, 15-hour surgeries, and to be in hospital till 3, 4 in the morning, and you're not even the person on call. So let's talk about how vascular surgery has been modernized throughout the years in terms of minimal invasive techniques. Endoscopic is the cornerstone of urology. As well as robotic surgery and laparoscopic surgery. But in terms of vascular access, let's not make any assumptions. What is a vascular surgeon, Dr. Lucas?
Oh, good evening, Bahamas. Thank you so much, Dr. Pinto and Dr. Francis, for having me on. This is a topic near and dear to my heart. What is a vascular surgeon? Even among surgeons and medical professionals, this is a little bit of an enigma. Everybody thinks they know what a vascular surgeon is, but I don't think anyone really captures the breadth of what we do. I like to think of us as team players, and we touch almost every specialty. Some of the areas that we commonly are known for are like veins. And, you know, we have our vein clinic, and we focus on venous disease and our venous ulcers. We commonly focus on our patients who have diabetic feet. We know that within the Bahamas and the Caribbean at large, we have one of the highest amputation rates in the world. I think the only population that even rivals us is Native American Indians in the U.S. and Canada. And so we have a unique population who has significant comorbidities. But we do much more. We talked about last week patients who need stroke prevention and evaluation because of carotid stenosis or blockages in the arteries supplying the brain. We help with access, so we work with our cardiologists to make sure that they can do their angiograms or their pictures of the heart. We do dissections and ruptures of the aorta, which is a big problem, is an emergency, and patients usually have minutes to hours before a decision can be made, or else they'll die.
Well, most people will die on the spot. It's only when that dissection is contained. So if that thing has a complete rupture, obviously they're going to die. But even that can be minimally invasively using EVAR repaired. And then a lot of your work, unfortunately, and we've spoken about this a lot, Dr. Francis, is related to trauma. So when you get stabbed, when you get shot, almost certainly you're going to get a blood vessel involved, either artery or vein, and you can bleed out from a vein just as easily as or inferior vena cava or even to your carotid artery or a stab wound to the neck. You're going to be there for 8 hours trying to repair the subclavian vein. Absolutely. Talk about your experience in terms of trauma, how it's basically overwhelmed your service, and do you think it's getting better? I know that we've spoken, Dr. Francis, the one good thing out of all the trauma in this society, if there is any good thing, is that we have an excellent trauma team, multidisciplinary in terms of surgical specialty, and that if anyone gets shot, if anyone's in a major accident and needs any surgical intervention, honestly, the best place in the world
Absolutely.
Is right here at Princess Margaret Hospital.
Princess Margaret Hospital.
Definitely in the region.
Is the trauma hospital and does trauma very well. It can mobilize, it has a full team in-house, and it can mobilize multiple different specialists at a hair's notice. Dr. Lucas has been a part of that. You know, what I wanted Dr. Lucas to, we should allow the public to know where did Dr. Lucas come from, how did he get here, what was his journey, why did he do vascular surgery?
And don't forget, you got to talk about your wife.
Yeah, I'll forget that wife.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much. Well, you know, I'm originally born and raised in Barbados, BIM as we love to call it. That is, you know, the birthplace of Riri, Rihanna.
Ah.
But yeah, that's where I did my schooling. I went to St. George Primary and Wilkie Cumberbatch. Shout out to our group. We're supposed to have a reunion soon. And I went to Harrison College. And from there, I went to University of the West Indies, where I then entered into the medical program. I'm starting off in Jamaica, actually. That was a wonderful experience. I did some internships and electives in Trinidad. I returned to Barbados, where I met a beautiful lady who stole me away from my home country. And that's my wife, Adrian. And I moved to the Bahamas with her. Continued my general surgery training. Dr. Francis at the time was head of department, I believe, but he was my mentor throughout that process and really helped me and inspired me to continue my dream, which was to become a vascular surgeon. One of the reasons I wanted to become a vascular surgeon is that we had such a high burden of peripheral arterial disease, as we talk about poor circulation, and about 60% of the beds at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which is the main public hospital in Barbados, basically was occupied by diabetic feet. And coming to the Bahamas, it was similar situation where we have so many patients who have diabetes and end-stage renal disease and foot complications that we have to treat. It's a huge burden on the healthcare system. And personally, I was affected. I talked about my maternal and paternal grandfathers having complications of diabetes, peripheral arterial disease, having amputations and infections, unfortunately dying from, you know, one from a heart attack, one from infection, okay? And I recognize, like, if there's anything I'm going to do in my life, it should be addressing this problem. It should be helping those patients. So every time I interact with a patient, it's like treating, I say, my mother or my family member, my loved one, because it touches me really closely. Sorry, and then as I completed my general surgery training in the Bahamas, I then did a fellowship at the University of Toronto, met some wonderful professors and colleagues, many of who I still keep in contact with. Mm-hmm. You've had the opportunity to meet some of them. They've come down to the Bahamas, Dr. Julia Chen, Dr. Greco, who was recently here at the MAB conference, wonderful mentor. And we've kept those lines of communication open. We've exchanged information and knowledge. And we've been able to implement certain firsts in the Bahamas. We've been able to push endovascular surgery, this minimally invasive surgery, and to great effect. And we've had some tremendous outcomes. We're moving from strength to strength. We've been able to have a minimally invasive conference. Dr. Pinto, I'm inviting you formally to be a keynote speaker, because we're trying to push patient advocacy and getting the patient's voice heard. A lot of people don't recognize that we have the talent in the Bahamas. There's so many procedures. There's so many procedures we can do. There's so many experienced people. Like just sitting on, look at this table. Right? And then at the Princess Margaret Hospital, at all the healthcare institutions, there's so many qualified healthcare professionals that are ready to offer their services. And I think oftentimes the public just doesn't know.
Right.
Right? And so that conference is going to be in April next year, 2026. We had a successful one this year. And we're just going to continue to push vascular surgery, minimally invasive surgery in all specialties.
So you mentioned endovascular surgery. Tell our audience a little more about that. What are the benefits? What is it? First of all, what are some of the benefits? And what are some of the things that you began implementing and changing what we do at Princess Margaret Hospital and in Nassau, in the Bahamas, rather?
Okay. Thank you for asking that question. So traditional surgery, when people think about, hey, you're going for surgery, they're thinking about first going completely to sleep. They're thinking about big cuts. They're thinking about a lot of pain and discomfort, and usually a prolonged hospital stay. They're thinking they're going to be in hospital for weeks or longer. And that is a major barrier we recognize to our patients accepting therapies and treatments and getting the right care. Minimally invasive surgery flips that whole paradigm on its head. We're talking about small, almost no incisions. We're talking about reduced pain. We're talking about options where people don't have to go to sleep. The area can be numb, like if you're going to for a dental appointment. And we're talking about better outcomes. You're talking about shorter hospital stay, less infection of the wounds because they're so small. And instead of using big knives and equipment to do the surgery and these long, nasty cuts, we're talking about pin sides, wires, and needles to actually open up vessels and do tremendous work. And every year is crazy how the field advances. It's something that we've been able to implement. Dr. Farquharson before me was doing some tremendous work with that in terms of endovascular angioplasties and revascularization. We've been able to build on that. We've been able to do TVARs, which is basically, as Dr. Pinto was talking about earlier, where we can actually put a device to heal or seal off ruptures of blood vessels. We've been able to save so many legs in terms of revascularization, especially for patients who may not be fit for general anesthesia, that is going completely to sleep. We've been able to help a lot of our trauma patients and our end-stage renal disease patients on dialysis. We've been able to do a lot of work in saving their abscesses, saving their problems in terms of blockages in the veins that stops them from getting dialysis, all endovascularly. So, you know, we've been able to push endovascular surgery slowly and steadily. A lot of investment personally from the nursing staff. They've gotten educated. They've come on board. Our theater nurses are very enthusiastic and really championed this new technology. I'm really impressed, and without their support, I wouldn't be able to do the things that I'm doing now, and that the vascular team as a whole wouldn't have accomplished so many successes.
So technology is not without its increased cost. And sometimes, even though there's an increase in upfront cost, I mean, overall cost is less because obviously patients stay in hospital less. The longer you stay in hospital, the more the cost is, and certainly endovascular procedures get patients out of hospital much faster. What challenges have you met or the team has met in terms of acquiring this technology and implementing it since you've been home?
So, another great question. Before I answer it, my wife was listening last week. She says, Charles, you never answer a question directly. You need to stop it. I apologize. But one of the things that I undertook before I came back from Canada was doing a study looking at endo versus open surgery.
Right.
And with a mindset of the Caribbean, the Bahamas, and something that's actually practical here. From that paper, what I was able to show was that within the first 30 days, endovascular is actually much cheaper than open surgery. So if you take that initial investment, you're going to see reap benefits, not in a year, not in 6 months, but within a month. You're and then when you think about the beyond that period of time, the complications and problems open surgery can bring, we found that endovascular in the bohemian context was a winner. Now,
I think even if you look at it just from the finances, yes, there may be more upfront costs, but it pays for itself within few years. If you look at open surgery, someone can be in hospital 3 or 4 months. They keep a bed for 3 or 4 months, and we're not just talking about a physical bed. We're talking about the nursing that's involved in a diabetic patient who had revascularization surgery, who may have to go in and out back to surgery to get it revascularized, the graft becomes clotted, et cetera. Just a debridement of a diabetic foot for 4 months, 5 months, takes an entire team, maybe sometimes 45 minutes, an hour, just for that dressing and that debridement of that foot every single day. I mean, the amount of resources it takes. And the most frustrating thing, and I've seen that through many years, and I'm sure both of you as well, is after a patient goes through that, there's so many of them, you'll see them back in 3 months, and they weren't taking their diabetic meds. They weren't coming back for follow-up. They were eating things they know they shouldn't have been eating. It goes back to the Bahamian mentality that we need to take care of ourselves and we can't overburden a system that's already overburdened. If you are this close to death, why are you going to do that 3 or 4 times? And I've seen some patients who are in and out of hospital in a 5 year period 12 times, 14 times. The hundreds and thousands of dollars that the government had to put into trying to save their limb or save their life, that money could have been put into educating their children or helping subsidize housing for them or building better roads or whatever. What is wrong with the mentality of not just Bahamians, but persons of Caribbean descent? Or why are we so hard-headed, essentially?
I think I can answer that in two ways. I think to tie into what Dr. Francis is saying, the challenges that we experienced were, one, patient education, and then provider education. One, letting them know that these services are being offered in the Bahamas, and then letting the patients know, hey, it's not all about big surgeries, you're not going to just amputate. There was a rumor going on that hospital doctors are given $100 or $500 to chop off your leg, things like that. So combating those rumors, combating the negative perception of surgery on a whole has been one of the biggest challenges. And then, as I said, getting the word out, what is vascular surgery? What are the options available for patients? So they know that, hey, it's not a one-stop shop. It's not only this that's going to happen. There's so many options that are available. And at different times in your healthcare journey, you're going to have the option A, B, C, D, as you like to say, available to you. So the upfront cost was another big challenge, getting the hospital and other authorities to invest. We've been supported, but sometimes the fund is not there. And we talk off air about, crime and violence and that the impact that has on other people in the hospital system who need care, and those resources being pulled away for dire, quote-unquote, dire emergencies that are entirely preventable has been a big, big challenge.
I mean, essentially, every elective list at some point in the week is going to be broken because they have a trauma case or someone has to be taken in for another exploration of post-gunshot wound or a revascularization. Obviously, life goes is more important than an elective list. And then it spirals out of control because you may have a surgical list that is booked out for the next 10 months, for the next 11 months. And if you postpone two people this week, you got to put them somewhere. And then the two other people, and it's just a cycle where patients get angry at the surgeons. As it's a circumstance. We work in very difficult circumstances with limited access to equipment, to supplies. Nursing staff is an issue. A lot of the nurses, I'll keep saying that, Dr. Francis will also herald that as well. They're the heroines of the medical system. It would implode if we didn't have those nurses in the front line in the emergency room. If we didn't have the nurses 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, trying to take care of 25 patients in the most difficult of circumstances. Some of the nurses, particularly in the orthopedic ward, they have to deal with sexual harassment and bathing patients. And yep. It's a horrible circumstance. The average person who would like to ridicule them couldn't last 5 days in that kind of circumstance with very poor pay, knowing that if they go off to the United States, they go off to Canada, or they go off to United Kingdom, they will have 5 times the salary. They'll improve the quality of life for themselves and their entire families. I think we need to recognize that you don't criticize someone until you know what it is to walk in their shoes. In terms of surgeons, we always get a lot of backlash. The difficulty of being on call all the time, seeing the worst of society, all the crime, all the trauma, all the stab wounds, it's unending. And I don't think we get the respect for what we do. We sacrifice ourselves coming out 3 o'clock in the morning in a very dangerous society. We spoke about this and I got your permission. You, in fact, were, when you came out to save somebody's life, you were held at gunpoint and someone trying to kidnap you at Princess Margaret Hospital. That wasn't put out in the media as far as I know. But these are circumstances where physicians, surgeons, nurses are threatened all the time. I know a female obstetrician gynecologist who was running and dodging a man with a gun in the PMH parking lot. I've known of women physicians coming home 3 o'clock in the morning from saving someone's life and someone trying to carjack them. So the public doesn't understand the circumstances. Every surgeon I know has had 2 scenarios or both scenarios where I don't know how these people get in. They pose as family members. Gang members will basically threaten you. If you go into this surgery with this such and such, he better live or it's you and me or we're going to put your life in peril. Or the opposite. You better not let this person live or we're going to finish him off and we're going to finish you off. And that's what we have to live with. That we have a very devilish, demonish society where violence is running rampant, and you don't know what the people are dealing with on the front line. It's never ending. Even as a vascular surgeon, as a urologist, I might get called if you get shot in the kidney or you get a stab wound to the bladder or a gun shot through the bladder or through the ureter. But you are always called. If you're going to get shot 12 times, almost certainly you're going to get multiple vessels damaged. And it's a horrible ordeal to try to repair them and save limb. And save life. Can you talk about your trauma experience and the overwhelming burden that it's causing on the vascular surgery discipline at Princess Margaret Hospital? So you don't even have time for elective surgery.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the unfortunate things about the burden that, you know, trauma in the Bahamas brings is, as you said, it takes away resources from other more elective or less urgent problems, but they're usually very, very important still. I'll take an example for our end-stage renal disease patients. You know, my heart goes out to them because they're some of the most lovely and patient people you'll ever meet, but they have to go through a lot. Our nurses do an excellent job trying to take care of them, but you know, we're trying to plan a list for our patients, trying to get them access so we can get hemodialysis, and in some cases, peritoneal dialysis. But as you said, the lifts get bumped. Or from a vascular surgery point of view, the equipment and resources I was going to use to help this patient get their dialysis access, I now have to use for a young gentleman who was in an altercation, you know, totally avoidable. And so I think this is where society can help us and the listening audience can help us find solutions and ways to combat the problem of crime and violence, you know, even car accidents, drinking and driving. These totally preventable causes of death and morbidity, that is, you know, they're very expensive, you know, and they take away resources from our patients who need it, whether it's our diabetic feet, our patients who have poor circulation, or people who are struggling with stroke, who are people who have heart attacks. We know in the process of providing pacemakers, I know there's a pacemaker program before, but we've barely ramped that up with Dr. Morris coming on board at the Princess Margaret Hospital. You know, I have a trained EP cardiologist
right.
who's pulling people from the brink of death. I saw it at least 3 times, getting the pacemaker in the nick of time, coming out in the middle of the night. As you said, with all of the insecurities of their own personal safety, making sure that we deliver quality care. And I want, and we talked off here about the nurses who are coming out in the middle of the night. They're hustling to get back to pick up for the children. They're missing important play dates. They're missing important time.
Yeah, they'll work the entire night. Some of them are I've known circumstances where nurses called in sick. They're short staffed. They're taking care of 2 adjacent wards, and then they got to go drive exhausted home to go drive their kids to school. So it's a very difficult circumstances. And Dr. Francis, I think we've mentioned this before. I would estimate if we didn't have such an excellent, well-oiled machine in terms of a trauma surgical team at Princess Margaret Hospital, the murder rate for the country every year would have been 15 or 20 higher than it is. What would you say in regards to that?
No, it's true. I mean, we especially at the end of the year, we would always be conscious and aware of what the murder rate was. And I remember years past, we would try to make sure it didn't go over 100, right? Certainly, we couldn't affect what happened in the streets, but anybody made it to the hospital, we just had to make sure, you know, they get the right treatment and hopefully the best outcomes and stay alive. I think now, I think we're doing better now. I mean, I think we're in the 70s, I believe, that's last I checked. So I'm sure some programs are causing that change or drop in crime, or violent crime like that. But certainly, we take that to heart because we don't want the Bahamas per capita to look like, you know, one of the other more violent countries. And so that was something that we prided ourselves on to make sure that any trauma patient that comes in through Princess Margaret Hospital was well taken care of, and they were. Now, people don't usually hear about that, right? But, you know, you hear about the bad things that may happen in Princess Margaret Hospital. Things
and
they, go viral and all that
and
other
you don't,
stuff.
You don't hear about the numbers in terms of attempted murder.
Right. And, well, I mean, you don't hear about the good things that come out of Princess Margaret Hospital. You know, Dr. Lucas said something. I remember when I first met Dr. Lucas, you know, he came over from Barbados. He joined our program. And you know, very careful in the way he took care of patients. And I think one of the proudest moments that I've had in seeing Dr. Lucas evolve and, you know, go off to Toronto and come back and, you know, really contributing. We had this really, really bad case, Dr. Major and I, this tumor that was really in a bad place in the liver, affecting the major vein that go into the liver. And, you know, I looked at this, when Major and I was looking at it, I was like, you know, we can get this out, but we're going to need some help. And we'll need some help from a vascular surgeon to put it back, put the vein back together once we take it out. Because we could have taken it out, but then it would be, the vein was going to be short. And I'm like, okay, well, Lucas is here. And, you know, it was a proud moment because here you have Lucas who went through our surgery program, went abroad, and got some further training, was able to assist myself and Dr. Major with a horrendous cancer case with the reconstruction part of it. If we didn't have him, we would not be able to complete that case, right? And this is kind of the multidisciplinary approaches that happen in Princess Margaret also, that people don't know anything about. But we hear about all these other things and, you know, the one-offs the bad things went off, go viral. But the good things, we don't. That guy is doing very well now, and I mean a horrendous tumor. So it was a proud moment to me to see. I took the thing out. I scrubbed out. He scrubbed in. I went to the lounge, chilled out for a bit, and came back when it was done, and then completed the case. And so these are the things that are happening in Princess Margaret Hospital that I'm proud of. And that's the application of vascular surgery. He extended our ability to do that case. Without them, we weren't able to. I don't know if you remember that case.
Oh, I do. All right.
Yes,
I left. We also got to say that we have every subspecialty in every field of medicine at Princess Margaret Hospital. So there are persons that who have gone all around the world and gotten experience and exposure and continue to go away and get exposure so they can bring cutting edge in everything
to medicine. Our healthcare system evolves when people go away, obtain the first world training and the volume of cases that you have there, get the experience and come back. That's how we evolve. That's a bit, that's been the history of this country in terms of the evolution of healthcare. And we need to continue to invest more in our healthcare system. But I think, and not only that, I think more Bahamians need to utilize our healthcare system, which in, that in and of itself becomes the investment in the system itself. What we tend to do is we invest in Florida's healthcare system, and to the detriment sometimes of our own. That has to change over time. If we are going to be self-sustaining in terms of technology for us, then that's what we're going to have to do. We have to do the investment, and then, you know, people got to utilize it. I think we have a caller.
Yeah, good evening. This is Urologist Speak. Sorry for the wait.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Pinto, and to your guest.
Good afternoon, good evening.
Yes, that's a sign of encouragement when you talk about if it wasn't because of your good doctors in the trauma section, the murder rate perhaps would have been higher. But I have a question. What could cause a patient who is under doctor's care or in BMH, what could cause them to develop bad sore?
Well, first of all, if somebody isn't ambulating, if somebody doesn't, so naturally you're going to turn from one side to the other. So if you are basically in a comatose or near comatose state, you're not going to feel that uncomfortable feeling that we'll just automatically in our sleep roll from one side to the next. So anybody, I've known persons who are, just went through a horrible ordeal and were depressed and basically just lay in the bed, didn't even gave up on life, and they developed bed sores just from depression. So if you don't move, you're going to get depression. I mean, you're going to get ulcers. The other issue is it can be because of you have very prominent, you've had weight loss or because of whatever disease or disorder that you have, you can have very prominent bony prominences. So you can have in your pelvis, it can be very prominent and you don't have any fat padding. Or, but to ask a nurse to essentially have a patient, if you know a patient is unable to turn or move on their own, you need to have what we have, we call specialized mattresses that are almost pneumatic, will basically inflate, deflate, or even the more primitive one is a rippled mattress, so you can have equal distribution of your weight. That is more of a financial investment into the public hospital than in terms of a failing of the nursing system themselves. So to ask, and I remember your circumstances you told me, I think it's your niece. During COVID, you wouldn't understand what was going on in COVID. Even, let me give an example. Even in New York, where my cousin is a professor and my brother is a gastroenterologist, they at one point were saying that even anybody over 60 didn't get an intubator. I mean, over 60 wasn't getting intubated. So you basically, if you went into respiratory distress and you were over 60, they were so overwhelmed, you basically died. They had trailer after trailer in New York of dead bodies. We as a system did better per capita than most first world countries, including the United States, in terms of COVID. But when I know at times when there was exposure or even actual COVID diagnosis, we would have half the surgery department out ill, or we'd have one third the nurses out because of COVID. So we were dealing with a skeleton staff. I know there were times there was one nurse during the heat of COVID dealing with two wards, three wards per shift. It's impossible. And these wards were overwhelmed with persons who had COVID and other issues. We weren't able to operate, so people were convalescing and getting worse and everything else. It was a horrible time. So whatever happened at that time is not the norm for even Princess Margaret Hospital, but I'm sorry what happened to your niece happened, but yeah, it's not to blame the nursing staff.
You know, and another thing, during the time she was in hospital, during the lockdown, nobody could have seen her, you know. Nobody could have seen her. But then she expired. We all could have come in the room that night. That was strange.
COVID was, I would see patients and there would be one person who got COVID and then two people next to them got COVID, three people in the other side of the ward, and I would see seven patients die within a week from COVID. So
I'm just saying,
yeah.
I'm saying that during that day,
yes,
nobody could have come to see her. Nobody could have get it
here. Bed sores don't develop in hours. They don't develop in days. It takes a long period of time.
And then another thing, and this one is for you, doctor, because according to the information that is out there that you received, so that all of the funding that goes through PMH, either to operate it, was told that 80% of the funding is paid to doctors, staff, and other benefits. Is that a normal ratio for public hospitals, or is that exclusive to the Bahamas, where 80% of the funding goes for salary?
I've never heard that, but let me say in defense, do you know how many nurses, student nurses who started off with a stipend and then they go off and maybe get married or have two children and 3 or 4 years later are still on a student stipend and owed money? Do you know how many physicians, including myself, would be six, 7 years and still didn't get your back pay and you're getting paid as a junior doctor when you're... I've never heard those figures, and I don't think that doesn't sound correct.
It doesn't sound correct.
No.
Well, I mean, the caller. I think what the caller is referencing, and it's the term that they use is personal emoluments, right? Which means a significant amount of the budget that's allocated to the hospital does go toward the staff. I mean, he says doctors, and maybe he's embellishing it a little, but the entire staff, right? There's a significant amount that goes toward the staff. And so, I mean, I've heard that figure before, maybe a little less than what he's saying.
Well, but, I'll also say, for example, we have friends in all the Caribbean countries. Right? We have counterparts who work for public system in Jamaica. They make far more money than at Princess Margaret Hospital.
But I mean, I think he's probably speaking to the management overall of the health system. And I believe that, we could be more efficient, right? And that's something that is really above and beyond us, beyond the scope of this radio show, obviously. And that's at the management and that's years. This is not like it happened yesterday. It's been years that a good amount of the budget dedicated toward PHA went towards personal emoluments. That happens. But that just speaks to, you know, there's an opportunity to better manage the system, for more resources to go toward operations in terms of really, you know, things in terms of, you know, equipment, in terms of new technology. Yeah, more money can go toward that. But still, what really makes up a health system too is really the staff. Because without the staff being there, right, nothing's going to happen. Okay? The human capital as part of the health system is very important. Yes, we could do better. And I would say that as someone who kind of studies health management, yes, we can do better. And I think he's pointing toward that. We acknowledge that. But let's try to look at problems as possible opportunities to see how we can make things better in the future.
Yeah, but I'm also going to defend the whole insinuation that physicians are greedy or
I'm sure that's not what he's saying.
Okay.
He might have embellished it a little bit. I'm sure that's not what he's saying. It's not about greed. And I mean, those funding that we're talking about goes to the entire staff. That's administrative staff. That's from the porter all the way up to the chief administrator in the hospital. That's what we're talking about. That budget doesn't go toward physicians per se, okay? And maybe he would like to find out what physicians do make in the public sector. And then he was like, wow, people don't know. And we're not here to disclose that, right? But for the level of training that all of us have to go through and what we do, it's really not, you know, where it should be. But yet, we're still here and we have to take care of the public. And that's important. We have to take care of the public, and we do that on a daily basis.
And there are many tragic stories, even in persons who are hired and they don't get paid a salary for 6 months, 9 months, 7 months. I came back and was paid just above the level of an intern for 20 months with no on-call pay, and I was on-call half of my life.
We all had to go through it.
Yeah.
We went through it. It's not good. It's not good.
Yes.
But we survived. It's an opportunity to make things better, right? But you know, the system has its deficits. I'd like to focus on the positive aspects of the system that we don't ever hear about, right? We have another caller.
Good evening. Okay. This is Urologist Speaks. Go ahead. Good evening.
Hello. Good evening, Doc. Can we talk?
Please do.
Okay, Doc. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
You might be surprised who that might be.
I think I know the voice.
I know, but see, the problem is, we as Bahamians, we need help from eye specialists, urologists, heart specialists, politicians, religious, all of this thing in this country, the way we're going through now in our lifespan.
I agree.
Now, I'm going to say something, that even sometimes we make mistakes, and we aggravate people even on talk shows. And they block people who want to ask people like you questions. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah. I'm not going anywhere.
Okay, so you might be surprised who this might be you speaking to, Doc. But, you know, I've been barred from calling the talk shows, even to talk to you about my physical health. My urology with my enlarged prostate.
Well, I would say, I don't know, this is the avenue for you to speak about your personal health concerns, but I'm always, you know where I am, you can always come and see me, and I know that you've seen me many times and I've never charged you a dime. We have another call coming in. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yeah, Dr. Pinto, I just want to make another point before I was hung up. But what I want to say is this: okay, you have a lot of patients, potential patients, right?
Yes.
Who, for whatever reason, they have this big fear about going to PMH because of, I guess a past experience. You see the videos with persons who end there and who end up dying because they felt as though they were getting the proper care. But let me put this question to you, doctor. Would you agree if I were to say that there is a large constituency of persons who need proper health care but will never be able to afford private medical insurance? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
I agree, but I think with NHI, that's created a safety net. Particularly drug program as well. It's also made it that persons who have innumerable non-communicable disorders can quote-unquote see a physician privately and get medications for free.
Okay, then We have this new hospital. We have just to follow up to my last question. We have this new hospital that is coming on stream, right?
Yes.
Where they're saying that they're going to deal with special situations and women and children, right?
Correct.
As if that the Bahamas don't have any males. I don't know why they've described the taxpayers' money like that. They're going to build a hospital for women and children. That just don't make much sense to me, who is a man and can also be subjected to being sick. But would doctors have any problem or any pushback? Yes, they, you know, you say that you all agree that there are a constituency of Bahamians who will never be able to afford private medical insurance or even private care. Would doctors have any objection to the government bringing in doctors from Cuba to assist this constituency of patients who need the proper health care, but their family can't afford it? Would you all have a problem with that?
I think that you'd be surprised to know how many qualified Bahamian physicians who are readily willing and able to service their own people. I think that you'll never get better care than from your neighbor, from your church member, from your family, from your distant cousin. I think that we produce a large number of physicians every year. I think that when you speak about these Cuban doctors, a lot of them have no access because of Cuba's in a horrible state now. I know some Cuban nurses, some Cuban physicians. I know some people who live in Cuba. They can't even get basic medication. They may have good fundamentals in terms of knowledge, of course, but in terms of them being on the cutting edge, of them being able to deal with endoscopic procedures, laparoscopic procedures, it's just not possible because they don't have the means and the resources for that. So we're trying to take the Bahamas to the next level. We're not trying to bring in a whole number of physicians who have no exposure and are unable to take the Bahamas to the next level in terms of technology and advances. And I will say it again, many of them cannot speak English. I've had that experience. So don't just think that bringing in Cuban doctors is going to solve all the problems. Let's hear your views, Dr. Lucas.
So I think from my point of view, we have a lot of talent and we need to build on it. We have a lot of experience. Yeah. There are a lot of young doctors. Dr. Nixon is going to be going off soon.
Yeah.
Dr. Nottage. Right. Getting super specialized, bringing top tier.
What I would say, and I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah.
Let's actually try and recruit the Bahamian specialists throughout the world who didn't want to come back for one reason or the other, instead of going and getting Cuban doctors who are there for economic reasons or political reasons, whatever. Even with my own family, I can name 10 super specialists, including my own brother, my cousins, who can transform the medical system in this country, publicly and privately, and they don't come back for one reason or the other. Let's entice them to come back. Let's invite them to come back. Let's embrace them. Let them try and uplift this medical system. That is what we need to do. We need to take back our own. Persons who spent their whole life in the Bahamas, went through high school, might have gone to the University of the Bahamas or even back when it was College of the Bahamas, went off and specialized, may have come back and did internship here or they were a senior house officer, went off and did subspecialty and just never came back home for one reason or the other. And many of it is because of the frustrations they see with specialists coming back and are very unwelcome. Let's, before we recruit foreign doctors for political points, let's bring back our own. That's my point of view.
It's also about the investment in our own healthcare infrastructure. That there's the human aspect of that, or the professional aspect of that. There's the technology aspect of that that needs to happen. And if we continue to spend all of our money in South Florida, you are never going to get healthcare infrastructure in the Bahamas to get to the level where it needs to be to continue to push healthcare innovation and new technology, and to attract those same, the diaspora who's out there. They're out there. They're basically getting better opportunities in the U.S. That's why they're there. But they could come home. And like I always say this, we want them to go somewhere else to train. One of the philosophies of our surgical program is you get a good fundamentals in our surgical program. We teach you how to operate. And then we say to you, go somewhere, get the new technology, learn the innovation, go into a high-volume system, come back and bring it so that we could expand what we have. And that's what's been happening. But in addition to all of that happening, what we need is Bahamians to now buy into that and to start utilizing our own and to realizing that our healthcare infrastructure needs to improve. But the only way it improves is you keep utilizing it so that the money spent elsewhere could be spent within the Bahamas to grow the infrastructure. That's what needs to happen.
And we talk about it all the time, brain drain. I'm even going back to when you went off and went off. Most of the persons who went off with us went off, particularly with you.
Didn't come back.
You were one of the only ones who came back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always say Dr. Sands. I mean, we just talk about Dr. Sands. He sent a number of us off, right? And I came back. A good number did not.
Most right? did not.
Most did not. But then this is how we build, though. Build on that.
Imagine what Princess Margaret Hospital would be like now if all everybody came back.
Yeah, it would be great. Yeah, but you know, people would still dog Princess Margaret Hospital. People would still not realize the phenomenal work that's being done there because nobody ever talks about it. They talk about the one bed sore that people get, and you go to Cleveland Clinic and get bed sore. You go to Baptist Health and get bed sore. It happens. Okay? And, you know, we don't just sit on our laurels and not do stuff about it. There's systems that put in place to prevent this, but it still happens, okay? Everywhere, every health system has its issues. But the only way we're going to grow is for people that leave to come back and for Bahamians to start utilizing and realizing that what they have and not, you know, go and purchase in healthcare elsewhere.
I mean, there's some Bahamians that with means who have an appendicitis and they
want to
be off
on the plane, for appendicitis. For gallbladder removal, for colonoscopies, all of these simple things. I mean, all of the things that Dr. Lucas does, right? Vein, I mean, you do a bunch of vein stuff and all of that stuff. People just jump on the plane and go away to get it done. How are we to invest in or to grow our own health system when we don't try to utilize our own health system? It doesn't work. There's an economy surrounding healthcare. And that economy here really is becoming an export. And then we complain about what we have and what we don't have, right? But yet we export and purchase things outside of the country. Now, I'm sure that's, you know, there are reasons to go, yeah. But for fundamental things that can be done here, that you have experts like Dr. Lucas, experts like yourself, and all the others that have trained, left, and went abroad and came back to improve our infrastructure, you know, that's what we have.
And I think we will be the first ones to say we want the best for our patients. So
absolutely. But they get the best.
Even for myself, right? Let's say 12, 15 years ago, I would be doing something because of the population and the large hospital and the volume that I was seeing. I was doing some surgery 4 times a week, and now I may not see that pathology, but once every 9 months, can I technically do the surgery? If I'm not doing it all the time, I'd rather send that patient off to someone who does it all the time. So it's not anything to do with ego. We put our patients' interests at the foremost importance. It's nothing to do with if we can do something here. It's not only if we can do it. Are we going to do it at the highest of levels? And possibly coming back to our society, a lot of our colleagues don't want to come back because, frankly, we lose some of our skills because we don't do the surgeries because of we have a smaller populace. Do you see that you're doing less vascular surgery than when you were, for example, in Toronto?
Certainly by volume, it is a bit less. But what I will say is that actually we have more peripheral arterial disease than even saw in Canada.
That happens,
you
yes,
know,
absolutely.
We have
more trauma, for sure.
Per capita, more dialysis patients.
Yes.
So for me as a vascular surgeon, it's rough. Because there are so many people that need our help. And just to tag on to what you're saying is, you know, the Caribbean, the Bahamas, we run the healthcare system on the East Coast and the West Coast and in America. If you check the background, I was so surprised when I did a fellowship. I walked into the vascular surgery operating theaters for the first time, and I saw a plaque. And it was of a Vincentian surgeon who had come, and he was a very tall guy. They called him Mr. Talls, I think that was his name. And he ran the program. And, all, you know, if you go to different hospitals in Brooklyn and everything, it's us, you know. It's Bahamians, Caribbean people running it. And unfortunately, we don't have the good PR to say, you know.
Yeah.
We're the same people, you know, training up there. Those are our brothers and sisters, our colleagues. We just jump over a couple.
And we decided to come home.
We decided to come home to give back, you know.
Right.
And it's funny, you know, people, I met patients overseas. You know, I was a doctor or my team was managing. And they're so happy to be there. And I'm like, but, you know, you could have got this done back home. I know for sure. Oh, I met a lady from Guyana. And she was so happy to be in this institution for something that could have been done in Guyana. And honestly, the time that she took making arrangements to come, she missed the boat and she lost her hand, right? But she was still with a dead hand, happy to be there.
Right.
When we know that the expertise exists, you know, locally and regionally. And as Dr. Pinto was saying, you know, we make sure that what we're trying to do is of the highest level. You know, because these patients go elsewhere anyway, they get second opinions, they go online. And so we, with the resources, the limited resources of developing countries, we are held to the same standard of the developed world, you know, and sometimes even to harsher standards. So, I mean, for me as a vascular surgeon, I think the volume is there. It is getting the patients the access, and that's why advocacy and health activism is so important for me. Getting the word out there that, yes, we can do things, and get to the hospital, get to your clinics. There's so many good primary care doctors. Get to them early so that we can do something, and it doesn't become a self-professing, a self-fulfilling prophecy where people are so afraid. I heard the call talk about so afraid of the Princess Margaret Hospital, so afraid to go into clinic, that they wait till they're on death's door. And then they come knocking. Please let me in. You come in. We're trying to do our best, but the boat has already left the harbor.
And that's the thing about...
And so then they say, oh, I came to the Princess Margaret Hospital I had an anticipated our day. So we want to get you early. We want to interact with you. We are your church members. We are your brothers and sisters. We are your neighbors. We want the best for you. And so, you know, we have the tools necessary to give you high-quality care, to give you high-quality advice.
Absolutely.
And we're not going to hold you hostage, you know. We're going to, if we need you, we're going to let you go to the special in the world, not just the U.S., Canada, Europe, wherever that is, where we have links to help you.
Right? I tell you, I've sent about a dozen persons to Hamburg, Germany, to one of my profs, because he's one of the top in the world. And I could have done the surgery, but this guy has 40 years of experience and he's world-renowned. So my patients will love me to death for that, because they realize that I wanted to advocate for them to have the best possible, and we always do the same. I've brought some of the best surgeons in the world who are household names, who have written chapters in urology fundamental textbooks, to come and operate with me, because they've done 10,000 of a certain surgery where hardly anyone in even the North America would have done even 200. So we've been very blessed to know some of the best in our field, and we have developed a relationship with them. You have brought people here who are some of the best in the world. I brought people who are some of the best in the world in our specialty. Dr. Francis as well has trained with them and brought them here or sent patients to them. So it's a network. The world is a huge place, but in terms of specialties and subspecialties, we meet each other at conferences. I've gotten to know urologists and Cleveland Clinic very well, because he was trained by one of my professors 10 years before me, and we have that interaction, and our prof put us together. So he would send patients to me all the time. I would get referrals from Cleveland Clinic, a Bahamian patient, you would say, why are you coming to me? Dr. Pinta can do the same thing just as well as me.
Same thing happens.
And I get a referral from Cleveland Clinic. Yeah. Yes, exactly the same.
But one thing I want to end on, because I know our time is up, right? This concept of the safety net hospital, and Dr. Lucas touched on it. I mean, Princess Margaret Hospital is a safety net hospital. There are a lot of patients out there who can't get private care, but they stay home and don't go to the one place that can help them and take care of them. And that's becoming a significant problem because of fear. And I understand why there's fear, but we have to improve on that. And as he said, you wait so late, and then times you get there, we cannot help you. And it's not the system itself. It's just you have to understand that this is your safety net, and you should access it as early as possible.
Well, I would like to say we're extending another invitation. We haven't gotten to all the vascular issues that we want, Dr. Lucas. So maybe in 2 weeks or a month you come back. I want you to go home and be safe in your environment. So you better say that your wife is Dr. Gomez Lucas and that she's a trained anesthesiologist.
Okay, specialist.
And she raised your children, but yet she accomplished. Any closing remarks, Dr. Lucas?
I just want to say health is wealth. I want our Bahamian people to take advantage of the talent in the Bahamas. Let's grow a healthcare system. Let's go from strength to strength.
And if somebody has any vascular issues, how can they get a hold of you, Dr. Lucas?
You can call me at 552-2352. I work at the Princess Margaret Hospital, Doctors, Bahamas Surgical Associate Center. And we have the new Bahamas Vein Clinic specializing in venous disease.
So the public just need to Google Dr. Charles Lucas, vascular surgeon. All right, let's have a safe Bahamas. Let's be good to each other, and let's be good to each to ourselves. See you next week.